Well, welcome to the panel, the iPad, the second coming of the CD-ROM. I'm glad to see some people are able to get up at 9:30, so I assume you either aren't hungover or you just never went to sleep last night, but we all appreciate you coming. It should be a really interesting panel. I've got some really great, smart panelists. We've actually had some interesting debates in preparation, and we clearly don't agree on a lot of things. So hopefully we won't get into fisticuffs, but I think it should be interesting. I'm going to start out. I'm Steve Globerman. I'm the CEO and founder of Enlighten. We're an Ann Arbor-based interactive agency. We work with a lot of big brands, doing all sorts of things to connect those brands with their consumers. But I actually started my agency in 1983, and I like to claim we were the first interactive agency, and I can claim it because no one else is going to say otherwise. But when we started working on floppy disks, and we were seriously doing interactive marketing and sales and content on floppy disks. And as technology changed, we changed. And what was really interesting is in the 90s, CD-ROMs became really popular. And, you know, when we started in 1983, it was a few years after the personal computer revolution started. And before that, people interacted with computers via mainframes and mini computers. And their access to them was, you know, these green screen terminals, really dumb terminals, sometimes now called thin clients. And when the PC came around, it was sort of the fat client. The experience was on the PC. You bought applications, and you ran applications on the PC. And what happened is, in the early 90s, the CD-ROM market started to explode. And there was all this amazing kind of content. And depends how old you are. Maybe you've experienced a lot of the cool CD-ROM content. But there was a bunch of immersive games. There was a lot of interesting books. And Randy from Random House knows that area, like publishers back then thought maybe CD-ROMs was going to be a new way for publishers. And the big titles back then, anyone ever remember like a game like Myst? Anyone ever hear of Myst? Yeah, so there's a few, you know, Seventh Guest. You know, Disney's Lion King was a huge hit like in the late 90s, or actually in the early 90s. And anyway, it was a really interesting time. You had great immersive experiences. People had CD-ROMs that were 30-speed CD-ROMs. And to sort of put that in perspective, that bandwidth is about 45 megabits. And so most people's connection to the internet today is still below sort of the bandwidth that CD-ROMs provided consumers back in the 90s. But then something called the web happened around 95, and it essentially killed, in a lot of ways, the CD-ROM market. CDs actually became considered old school because you actually, you know, you'd produce it, you'd ship it, you couldn't change it, and the web was exciting technology. And part of the excitement of the web was some of its, the ethos of the web, the openness of it. There was neutrality. No one owned the web. You know, anyone could put content on the web. And it was just people's interest in getting information quickly, like, far outpaced their desire, in a way, to get sort of immersive experiences. And so what happened is CD-ROMs just went away, and a lot of people really didn't care. And a sort of a funny story is, like I said, I had my interactive agency since 83, but when the web came out, half my company didn't want to work on the web. They thought the web was, like, disgustingly bad because they were used to creating these full-screen immersive experiences, and the web was, like, a bunch of text and links. But you know what happened. We should have just dove into it immediately, but we still are able to sort of catch up. But so, like I said, a lot of the immersive experiences just people didn't pay that much attention to. Obviously, you could build things in Flash as years went by, but really nothing really changed. And then about almost 2 years, you know, to the day Apple, released the iPad. And, you know, it's to me what was really amazing about that was, you know, you could go back to 94 and look at the top 100 selling CD-ROM titles, and all those same kind of titles started to come out on an iPad. These, you know, immersive storybooks, all sorts of interesting games. And to me, it was just really fascinating how we went from sort of the mainframe, sort of, you know, thin client to the PC fat client to the web where the PC was really more of a thin client. And now sort of the iPad sort of bringing back sort of the fat client again, where a lot of the application it plays, you know, on the tablet. Now, obviously, the tablets are different. There's way more connectivity to the web. But, you know, to date now, Apple sold about 55 million iPads. There's about 100 million tablets out there. I think Apple alone says they have about 200,000 iPad apps. So it's really sort of this amazing market. And in fact, what started as sort of maybe a tablet for a certain kind of content, and you'll hear from the panel, is sort of expanding and sort of maybe getting us into sort of this post-PC era. But anyway, what this panel is going to discuss, and I'm actually mostly going to be moderating because I've got some really smart people here, we're going to talk about what the iPad has done in terms of making interesting content. You know, what about a tablet has created this? Sort of where are the opportunities? What's sort of the business models out there? Because, you know, in the CD-ROM days, you know, an average CD-ROM cost between $100,000 and $2 million and took 6 months to produce. And very few people made money on that. And they sold for $49.95 to up to like $99.95. I think most of you realize the prices of apps in the App Store aren't anywhere near that price. But I don't really think the cost to produce some of these things has gone down significantly. So I think that's sort of an interesting, you know, discussion, as well as we'll sort of talk about maybe the future. So with that, I want to introduce the panel, and I'll start with Brian Burke. And I'm going to read his exciting bio. So Brian is president of Smashing Ideas, and that's a digital innovation studio that has created multi-screen experiences for over 16 years for top brands such as Disney, Nick, Mattel, Sony, GE, Panasonic, and others. Since the launch of the iPhone, Smashing has created over 30 apps, with several hitting the top 10 to top 50 lists. Its e-publishing efforts are at the forefront of the digital transition for the publishing industry, working in close collaboration with its main partner and parent, Random House, who you'll meet momentarily, to bring its titles to life. He's a huge music fan, drummer, and guitarist, and he's bummed that he'll miss the rock and roll mayhem at the music side of the festival. There's Brian.
There you go.
And to Brian's left is Randy Rosenkratz. She's vice president of digital development at Random House. It was really great to get a sort of a publisher's perspective. And she oversees mobile application development for all of Random House's publishing divisions. Prior to her time at Random House, Randy led multidisciplinary teams in the creation of enterprise content management systems, portals, websites, and mobile applications for various media and entertainment companies, including Scripps, which is the Food Network, HDTV, DIY, The New York Times, The New Republic, Paramount Digital, and so forth. Randy also spent 8 years in various sales and business development roles with major book publishers, including Random House and Simon & Schuster, before jumping into the technology world. The other notable thing about Randy, she got a degree from the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, where we're based.
Good Ann Arbor plug. Yes.
And finally, Calvin Carter. Calvin is the CEO and founder of Bottle Rocket Apps, a full-service mobile app development firm focusing on creating handcrafted apps for the world's most discriminating brands. Since its founding in early 2008, Bottle Rocket has completed more than 60 iPhone, iPad, and Android apps for leading brands such as NPR, PBS, Disney, ESPN, TBS, and many others. The company's apps have won numerous industry accolades, including multiple Apple Hall of Fame awards, and frequently appear at the top of their categories on the App Store. Calvin and the Bottle Rocket work their magic from the company's offices in Dallas, Texas.
Good morning, everybody.
So with that, I'm just going to kick it off. I'll kick it off with Brian. And obviously, this is sort of the big question. I think a lot of you might weigh in on this, is sort of what is really different about the tablet experience versus the web, and why are we seeing all this sort of new kind of content?
You know, it's interesting because we're a pretty good-sized studio, and we've done a ton of web content over the years. And I think what it comes down to, the difference is that when the iPad came out, or even when the iPhone came out, we were asked to think a little bit differently. In fact, think very differently. So it was actually about opportunity. The way we thought about design, the way we thought about user-centered design, the way we thought about human interaction with content was much different than with a mouse, right? So I think in a lot of ways why it's different is we were challenged with something that was super exciting. It's not that the stuff on the web wasn't exciting, because, you know, building for the web is obviously a staple across the board for us. And, you know, obviously the web is merging so much right now, so with mobile. And the reason why we're seeing new experiences is because people are actually thinking in terms of designing for the device, designing for actually how people will interact with the device. And the type of content that's coming out is so friggin' cool, and it's so much fun right now. And so I think, I'm just going to give a couple examples of where I thought it was like, you know, game developers or, for example, someone on the e-publishing side, actually us, I'll talk one really quickly about it, but we thought a little bit differently about. There was this game actually called Spider. Did anyone play Spider, Bryce Manor, Secret of Bryce Manor? For me, that was the first. I've been in games for a very long time, and when I saw Spider come out, and I saw how they used the real estate on the device, and then when it went to the iPad, the idea of being able to throw the silk of the spider, create a web, that was such a different game mechanic than I'd ever seen before. I could never imagine doing that with a mouse, actually. I just couldn't, because it was like all of a sudden, I couldn't be the spider with a mouse. But I could almost be the spider with this device, the ability to throw the silk. When we started our e-publishing division in 2010, we hired this guy who was actually a contractor for us, and he came out and he said, I've just created this kind of cool book. It's called Alice for iPad. And I'm like, that's the coolest thing I've ever seen. What can you do next? And so he created this app called War of the Worlds. Actually, it was a rendition of War of the Worlds. One of the best scenes that I loved about it was thinking about content is that there's this one scene in it where there's a foggy window. And it's, you know, like whenever you see, like, you know, condensation on your window, and his idea was, like, I want to basically show that, like, that's, like, you can wipe off the window, and you can then see through the window. You couldn't do that right on the web, so it was that whole thing, and the sound was like, you know, the squeaking of wiping the condensation off of the window, and then all of a sudden the tripod came through, and you could see this cool sort of experience. So to me, it was like people started thinking about the device. They started thinking about the gestural side of things, and not that you can't do that on the web, but there is something very removed with a mouse that just literally, it's giving us the opportunity to think differently completely, so.
Well, Calvin, I know you have strong opinions on sort of the whole tablet experience.
Yeah, definitely.
So answer that and sort of why you sort of initially too, like all this sort of content that was sort of existed way in the past, you know, immediately sort of came out, on a tablet that sort of skipped sort of the PC generation.
Sure. So Brian did a really good job of describing how designers and developers of the platform approach it. Another way to look at the same question is how does the user approach it? And the iPad, nothing has ever finally given users a deeply intimate and human and physical relationship with content. And I know that sounds a little strange, but frankly, you have to go there to understand how to really leverage the platform and what the iPad means to the future of what we believe is a human content interface. We all understand HCI, human computer interface, and we've been spending a lot of time, decades, trying to tweak that human computer interface. And a computer interface would be a windowing system and mouse and pointers and, you know, all that shit that frankly you don't need. The user doesn't want. You kind of had to have it, but the user doesn't want that. They don't need that. So when you look at the iPad, watch how users interact with an iPad. They hold it. They embrace it. They bring it into their personal space. We all understand the concept of the personal space. They bring it into their personal space. They work with it like it's a physical representation of the content that they are interacting with. They use their entire arm. You're activating more neurons when you do that. You also have the opportunity to, with multi-touch and gesture, where designers will be like, hey, let's use a lot of like analog metaphors. And right now, analog metaphors are, people are starting to get kind of sick of it, and they're wondering what the next thing is. But the analog metaphors are what is helping people kind of move to this experience. And over time, people are simply not going to want, not just need, but they're going to start rejecting controls that separate them from content. So, like Steve was saying, there's a lot of things that was really cool on CD-ROM in terms of an immersive experience, but it was never, you were never connected to it. It was always a couple of feet away. It was up at a right angle to your face. You had to put your whole body in an uncomfortable position to be part of that content. And frankly, you could never have an intimate relationship because you were always touching something that touched something else, that moved a pointer, that moved a window, that moved a control to touch the content. And I feel that the iPad is simply an iteration of technology of removing barriers between the human and the content that they want to have a relationship with.
Okay, so Randy, obviously you've been on a lot of sides here. You're on the publishing side now. When you look at the tablet and the rapid adoption, you know, how does it affect your sort of Random House's overall strategy?
Well, you know, when the CD-ROM first came out, the major book publishers sunk a ton of money into CD-ROM development and frankly really got burned. We put a ton of products out there. They sold for a little bit. The market went away. And so we kind of stood in the background a little tentatively until the Kindle launched in 2007, I believe, maybe 2008. But, you know, e-ink is great for a linear book, not great for an interactive experience. And, you know, while the iPhone became popular and was adopted, you know, people were still a little intimidated by the CD-ROM experience, frankly. But when the iPad launched, we suddenly had a way to take all these other kind of genre books, things like children's books, travel books, education, language learning, any kind of, like, cooking, and we had a way to create an immersive experience. And, you know, frankly, we dove in pretty hard. You know, we purchased Matching Ideas. We work really closely with them. We try our best to take advantage of all the functionalities that the tablets offer to create a really exciting and immersive experience that belongs on that device. I don't really think Random House believes that we should throw our fishing books, for instance, that people want to read, like the next John Grisham book. That's great. You can use your Kindle or you can use your Kindle app. Or your Nook app to read it, but we really want to create products on the iPad that are engaging. We want to educate, we want to entertain, we want our users to be smiling at the end and wowed by the experience that we've created.
So Randy, so you said you got, you know, the publishers got burned in the CD-ROM market. Why don't you feel you're going to get burned in the tablet market?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's not to say that we won't. I don't know. What has been at least going on in our teams internally is I work really close with the people who produce our enhanced and complex ebooks, and we're constantly looking at this ever-shifting, basically evolving market and trying to figure out where the product belongs. Does it belong in the ebook store? Does it belong on the app market? And over time, that's something that's transitioning. So we have to really take a good look at our content and decide where it belongs and what's the best bang for our buck,
right?
Okay. So to speak.
Yep, okay. So obviously, you know, when the iPad first came out, there was a set of type of, you know, applications that came out, and as it becomes more and more prevalent, it's actually becoming bigger and bigger. But I'm sort of curious, Brian, like, the categories that you think so far of the kinds of content that have come out on iPad that you think have been either the most successful, mm-hmm. the most engaging, the most profitable, and really the areas that you're actually most interested in.
Yeah, it's interesting because I originally thought, you know, from a gaming perspective, because I love games, and, you know, and that's, I play way too many of them. And so, and I mean, like on the iPhone, honestly, or the iPod Touch, or actually back in the days, you know, pre-iPhone, big mobile gamer, and I thought, man, it's going to transition really well to the iPad. And I found, actually, that this is personal, right? So, I mean, so I'm saying the weight of the iPad kind of bugged me after a while. And I found that we'd actually did this game called Robot Unicorn Attack for Adult Swim. And then we did Heavy Metal Robot Unicorn Attack. And then we did Christmas Robot Unicorn. And then we did Robot Unicorn Attack HD for the iPad. And I found that when I'm holding the Robot Unicorn HD for the iPad, that I was like, you know what? I'm not getting it. I mean, I do enjoy it. Don't get me wrong. It was a top 10 title, and it's beautiful screen and everything. But I found that, you know, with gaming, I do believe it's, you can do it very well on the iPad if you truly understand the use of the screen real estate. I think for tower defense games, I actually think it's a perfect device for it. In fact, one of the games I'm playing right now is called Kingdom Rush. Does anyone play Kingdom Rush? I'm friggin' addicted. I'm 20, 25 hours in on the thing. And I mean, unfortunately, I finished it, but I can't wait for the update. So, But that is perfect because they're actually using the full screen real estate, and it makes sense to me. I play Pichirica with my kids sometimes on it, and it's turn-based, but it works well because if we're on the road, it works well. But I will say that there's a reason why we launched an e-publishing division, because that seemed to be the most prominent reason of what we thought would be the best use of this device. And I've just been really impressed. You know, some of my favorite ones are The War in Pacific from DK. I like Civil War Today as well from you guys. Really well done. And I love the stuff we've done for Random House, too. And I mean, because it actually made us, it was a time for us to think a little bit differently about the book and reference content. So that category alone is really exciting to me.
Okay. You know? So Calvin, I know that Calvin believes that, you know, iPad's going to be used for every single thing. But if you try to focus a little bit to date where you think the most success has been, and also maybe just your personal interest, why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So, I mean, if you want to look in the past, gaming is obviously a massive part. So I'm going to put game aside because, you know, everyone knows that. Obviously, other very successful types of content on the iPad are news, up to the minute type of experiences, media brand experiences, and let me just take a minute to kind of talk about. Really how you can make the decision about your own content. Think about the role of the device, what the role of the device plays in the user's life. So there's a role that this plays in my life, and there's a role that the iPad plays in my life. And if you're trying to make a decision about is the content that I own, that I license, publish, whatever it is, where should I go? Should it go iPad? Should it go phone? You can really get sidetracked by looking at a lot of stats of installed base of devices and whatnot. Really start looking into the role of the device and then how your content fits into their life. So, for example, I will launch this. I carry this everywhere I go. It's the first thing I touch in the morning, the last thing I touch at night. I like to say that iPhones and phones like the iPhone are from boardroom to bathroom. You literally never disconnect with them, and you use them everywhere. Let's be honest. We use them everywhere. An iPad is a little bit different versus the iPhone, where you're usually in motion, many times standing. Your body is moved forward. You hold it with one hand, and you navigate it with the same hand, your thumb being the main navigation tool. And you probably hit that home button about 150 to 250 times a day if you're an average person. And you use this now to make phone calls. About 6% of your usage is using this for phone calls. 65% is third-party apps, and the rest is email and text. This guy over here, you use usually like 2 to 10 times a day. You're usually seated. You're usually in a strategic thinking mindset versus kind of like a fight or flight type mindset. And this is where you're making deeper decisions. You're reflecting. You're many times relaxing. Many times this is your me time. You're 10 minutes in the Starbucks, that sort of thing, or when you're on a plane, that sort of thing. So be thinking about your content and how does your content fit in their life, and then make the decision and platform on that. If you want to talk about the future of potential areas that are probably for the next 12 months going to explode on iPad, I think you're going to see a lot of interactive books that kind of start to really, really kind of play with it, and I think most of them will miss the mark. There's a lot of book type content that makes a lot of sense. Like, I'm a big fan of Pop Out Peter and, you know, things, experiences like that. But there's a lot of other books that, frankly, you just want to read the damn book and you don't want to get distracted and all this other crap. Yep. And I think the publishers need to really be okay with still having a storyline that is a book type of an experience. Broadcast media is a huge opportunity for iPad. Both primary and secondary screen apps for the next 12 months is going to kind of reinvent our relationship with television and reinvent our relationship with broadcast media. And I can go industry to industry, yeah. But I don't want to bogart all the time.
All right. So Randy, you know, you mentioned sort of decision of when to do an app versus an ebook, and Calvin sort of mentioned it as well. And I'm also really very interested in it because the classic sort of novel stuff, you know, that just makes sense as an ebook. But then you have this other kind of content, and, you know, we've discussed this before, where you can make this really great immersive experience and have a, but then the cost goes like way, way up. But you know, as I said, you know, you put 10 people in a room and you show them a standard illustrative book in sort of a page-turning metaphor, or you make it really engaging, you know, 10 out of 10 are going to like the engaging one. But can publishers afford to do that? And what is really the criteria that you use to try to decide, like, I'm just going to stick it out in an EPUB format, or whether I'm going to invest with Brian and you know, build something really cool?
Yeah, well, you know, we're kind of in a transitional phase right now. The ebook apps can only do so much right now, and that's changing. There are products that we put out in the App Store a year ago that today I would, frankly, put into ebook. So we really take a look at the property and think about what we want it to do. And are those things possible using the ebook apps? So a lot of times we'll put things into the App Store in a way to push our retailers to improve the technology of their ebook apps, frankly, right? So we take something like, for instance, Pat the Bunny. Pat the Bunny was published, I don't know, 40 or 50 years ago, and it was considered the first interactive book. I don't know if you remember it. It's literally a little square book that you, like, pat the bunny's little furry back, and, you know, you look in a mirror and you do all these little things, and it really changed the way books were published for children. So we thought it would be an interesting challenge to take that and reinvent the way a children's book could be seen in the App Store. And, you know, we did things in that app using technology on the iPad that you couldn't do in ebooks. For instance, we use the front-facing camera, and we literally have a scene in that story where the child can look at themselves in a mirror. That's not something you can do in an ebook. Over time, the ebook technologies will improve, and at that point, we'll probably put more into the ebook store, and we'll use the App Store to explore, I would say, probably more revenue model tests, right? Like freemium models. Can we put a certain amount of content out there? The consumer likes it enough that they'll buy additional packs, or we can use it for things that we can easily update. So it's definitely going to change as time goes on.
I would add one quick thing. I really like what you said, because don't worry about kind of like the categories of the App Store now. I understand that that's like a rule set we have to deal with as publishers on Apple's App Store, but that will evolve over time. Newsstand Kit is something that is extremely successful for Apple and for publishers of magazines. Spin Play, which is Spin Magazine for iPad, saw a 2,400% increase in downloads when they moved from standard app in the App Store to Newsstand Kit in the App Store. And that will continue. I wish it would go a little faster, but I think you're going to see kind of like an interactive books type of thing. You're going to start seeing better segmentation, I believe, with catalogs as well. You're going to start to see a lot of ways of taking kind of traditional construct publications and enabling them with technologies that are very important for that particular construct, like Newsstand and all the things, the cool things it does for periodicals like magazines. And I think that that is something that is simply going to continue, and you really kind of have to get in the game and then move with it. If Spin decided to wait before Newsstand, before going onto the iPad, they would have missed a massive business opportunity. So they went onto the App Store, and then when an opportunity opened up to improve what they're doing on the App Store for their magazine, then they moved to that.
And actually, just to add one more thing, another way we've been using the App Store is to create things like games. You know, we create original IP on a game called Stunt Bugs, and it gives us an opportunity to start working in other mediums that weren't available us, you know, before in just the ebook apps. And, you know, is it possible for a publisher to create a successful product like a game and then publish books from that?
Right. So that's a good transition. I want to talk a little bit about the business models out there. You know, my company, Brian and Calvin, primarily get paid by people to build apps. And these guys do some different things too. Randy, on the other hand, they're investing money, and they actually need to they need to make their money on the other side. So I'm curious from your guys' perspective, because, you know, as I mentioned before, you know, you guys know the costs, and you maybe could throw out some what you think typical costs are on these apps. And, you know, they're not that different from the CD-ROM days at some level. but the price points are significantly lower. Now, obviously, the market's bigger. So where do you think, like, the opportunities are, and where are the profitable business models?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think that, you know, there are – the price points actually sometimes are not that much less, because if you want to build a breakthrough experience, it does start to cost money if you don't want to templatize experience.
Yeah, exactly.
So it does. I mean, we've done some pretty extensive projects that are really getting up there on the price point. But the question always comes back to, what's your return on investment? What do you expect? What are your metrics for success? And, you know, as a services business primarily, we talk to a lot of our clients and say, there's times when we go, maybe you shouldn't do an app. Maybe you shouldn't do a Facebook app
unless
as well.
They wanted to spend $1 million.
Yeah, exactly. Unless they wanted to spend the money. But,
and that
but
it, would been, then it would have been a good idea.
Exactly. But to this point, from the earlier question as well about the categories, it's like there are times when you shouldn't do an app. There are times when just this rush, it's maybe not a rush anymore, but it has matured to the point where we have to think a little bit more, a little deeper about why we're doing it. Because I'll say, you know, we've been in mobile for a long time, and I remember I was at an Espoo in Finland talking with Nokia and giving a presentation out there, and one of the head guys in content said to me, and this was years ago, he goes, Brian, in a Finnish accent, of course, he says, I won't say that, but he says, Brian, you know, just because you can do it in mobile doesn't mean you should, and there should be a reason why you're doing it. And, you know, I thought about it because we were trying to just shove a lot of different utility apps into these little devices, and we weren't really thinking, back to even Calvin's point, about how people would actually use them. So I think relative to the business models, you have to ask yourself, why are we doing this? If we get 100,000 people to download this, does that make it for us? Or if we get 2 million, does it do it for us? I will see in the gaming space, like for example, I think it's been wonderful because it does allow us to take games that normally would have been free flash games or whatever online that would have been ad supported, that would not have gotten the CPM, effective CPM that you would really want, and are viewed as premium content now. So there are revenue models for small game developers. And I think it's awesome because I'll tell you, like, what all of a sudden happened was Apple gave us the opportunity as game developers, not us because we're fairly big, but a small two-man, three-man shop to compete against the EAs of the world. And I think that's really cool, the ability to actually put something out there. It also gave categories like retail the ability to think a little bit differently about how they present their content and the tools that when people go in-store, et cetera. So,
Well, for a publisher, I mean, it's still sort of a hit business, right? I mean, I'm sort of curious, Randy. I mean, is most of this an investment for Random House? Or are you looking at making money, like, on all this stuff that you're putting out?
Well, I think it's both. My group is, as right now, considered R&D, but very soon I'm sure that will change. And we will have to start justifying the cost. But, you know, I regularly have conversations with Brian's team about projects that lend themselves so well to the App Store in so many ways. And we think of fantastic things that we can do there. But frankly, the cost of development doesn't warrant the number of downloads that we're going to get. And sometimes we have to make a hard decision. Do we decide to put in the money and the investment and the time, knowing that we most likely won't make our money back, and consider it learning? You know, there are a lot of times that we'll create products because we have to show our agents and authors that Random House can do it, and we can do it well, and we can get our apps promoted on iTunes, and we can get onto the bestseller list, and we can do interesting promotions in-store at Barnes & Noble. And I think that, you know, playing with the various models that you have in the App Store, such as freemium versus paymium, is interesting for us because it's not really something we could do before. I mean, in e-book stores, we either give something for free or it has a cost. And there's not really that merging of the two. So being able to test the waters and, for instance, see how much content it takes to get that good conversion rate. We had built an app that, frankly, we realized we were giving too much for free. It was a language learning product called Living Language, and we gave so much content out for free that people got scared, and they realized, like, at first they thought it was easy, and then they're like, wow, it's really hard to learn Chinese. I'm not going to spend the money for the rest of this app. So we realized, you know, cut it back. Give less content. Let them feel like they've achieved something, and then they will invest the money. So
Calvin, if there's people out here that are, like, sort of, they've got app ideas, you know, they want to, maybe they feel they can develop them. Is it a really good business model for people to try to create original content or try to license content and curate it and release it and actually have a hope of making money?
Sure. It's an unbelievable business opportunity. But I think it's important to to look at what the return, what the desired return on investment is for the person you're describing. There's lots of different types of return on investment.
Most people like the money kind of return, by the way.
Everything converts to money eventually. So because we have such a broad spectrum of customers that we work with, some of the app projects that we do are given away free on the App Store, and it's mainly to produce brand exposure that might convert to dollars at a different time. Like, for example, our Discovery Channel for iPad. Can you imagine Discovery Channel not having a kick-ass iPad app? You would be very disappointed in the brand, and it would affect your relationship with Discovery Channel's brand if it had a crappy iPad app. So there's a return on investment there. There's also tune-in opportunities where a well-designed app can basically convert and direct your attention back to the brand in appropriate ways. Those are opportunities for greater tune-in, greater traditional advertising spends. Also, there's more literal opportunities to make money, like ads inside of the mobile app. And that's just one. And then there's e-commerce opportunities. There's product placement and e-commerce opportunities. Also, sponsorship and deep campaign opportunities, which are different than just plain advertising opportunities. And that's just one industry and one app. Then you go to games, because we have a business inside of Thruster called, inside of Bottle Rocket called Thruster, and we produce games like Annoying Orange, Kitchen Carnage, and games for Freddie Wong and our own IP. And what we have found there is that on the gaming side, it is insane the number of different variations of revenue models. We do, you know, pay to download. We do free to play with an ad model, and you pay to remove the ads, or you pay for in-app purchases in microcurrencies, always allowing the true gamers to earn their money through game performance and gameplay, and allowing a more kind of a casual gamer to buy into the point system to progress through the game. For a lot of publishers, kind of the holy grail is the auto-renewing subscription model. And I think a lot of people get frustrated with how, you know, I'm spending this money on an app and I can't make money, because they expect the App Store to make them successful. The App Store is an amazing distribution ecosystem, and it's so much more than just distribution, but we don't have time to go into that. But a lot of people just expect, hey, I want to be like that Trism guy. I want to put, you know, an app on the market and just kind of have the App Store make me rich. That's not how the App Store works. That happens from time to time. But you still have to have a strong business model. You have to pull people through that store. And I think that it's important to, when you're developing the game and you're working really hard and all the code and all the creative, you have to have at least 20 to 25% of your hours on a project need to be, what is our revenue strategy, our business strategy? Many times it's just like, well, the easiest thing to do is upload it and sell it for 99 cents. That's a mistake. Don't do that. Don't take 2 months or 20 months or even 2 weeks of your hard work and throw it out there for 99 cents. I can tell you as a four-year veteran of the App Store, you will make the least amount of money on a 99-cent download. Don't believe you're going to be the next Angry Birds. Think deeper and work harder on your revenue model, and think about, frankly, things that are harder to do but are better payoff in the long run.
Right. You know, I'm gonna touch base on this too, since we're talking about also the CD-ROM, and you know, it's funny because you started off talking about the CD-ROM. We used to charge $49.95 sometimes, $29.95.
Those were cheap.
Yeah, exactly. And those were cheap, you know. And you think about it, and I go even in the downloadable game industry. I mean, the downloadable game industry, in my opinion, saved online gaming, because I was at Shockwave and we were doing free games. Ad market went, and then all of a sudden it was like, thank God, people will pay $19.95 for a game. But I will say, this is what's, and, you know, to your point too, Calvin, is that it's like, and Randy, it's like trying to figure out the business models for this, how we make money. I will say the downward price pressure is very difficult, because I do see cost. I mean, we constantly have to improve what we're doing. We constantly have to break new barriers. In the CD-ROM, you had this house, this package of content that had a perceived value that was at $49.95. Now, whether how much it cost us to make that was one thing. But guess what? Apps can cost a lot of money. And when you're charging $2.99, you can have every marketing strategy in the world. But there are times when you have to ask yourselves, how much is too much? And what is really the plan here? You really now more than ever have to think about your marketing strategy outside of the App Store, because that's the point, because Apple won't do it all for you. You have to think, this is an opportunity. How do I maximize this opportunity? It will cost me X. People see the value as $2.99, $4.99. 10 years ago, would have paid $29.95 for it. Very interesting market. It's a volume play all of a sudden. Right. So, well, yeah, I mean,
it's also a very disruptive market out there for especially like traditional publishers. I mean, we work with some publishers. You know, they're selling their stuff in the Apple App Store, and Apple keeps on telling them they need to lower their price to sell more. And it's like, we don't want to lower our price. So, I mean, it's...
You know, that being said, though, I will say that our children's group did an experiment last Thanksgiving. They decided that they were going to take, I think, 8 of their apps that are priced typically between $2.99 and $4.99. And for the 5 days leading up to Thanksgiving, where people were going to be in their cars on road trips with lots of bored screaming children, and put all their apps on sale for 99 cents. And they did a whole PR push around it. And the money we generated in those 5 days, even at the reduced price point, was more than we typically generate in those time frames, right? I don't think you can do it all the time, and I agree with Calvin. I don't think we should be throwing content out there at low price points, because I think our content has value, and I think we need to prove that to consumers by producing great content. But the App Store does allow you to do great promotional things that we couldn't really do before, right? And get a lot of notoriety. I mean, there are all those websites out there that just track app prices. And they'll alert their consumers that things are on sale. And then you get these people who are basically bargain hunters. But by doing that, you'll push your product back onto the bestseller list.
Right.
And the key is, once you do that, is keeping it there. Once the price goes back, that's what the challenge is.
Exactly. All right, let me switch gears a little bit, and then we're going to have some Q&A time, too. So, you know, Calvin and Brian both have agencies. They have lots of, you know, the strategy, designers, UX, programmers, same kind of skill set that was required to create CD-ROM content, I mean, with some slight differences. And in some ways, in a general category, same kind of skill sets required to create websites. But when you look at sort of building the apps that we're seeing now, what kind of different skill sets are required? Can someone just really transition a team that was building sort of websites and say, now we're building apps?
I'll be real quick. I mean, so for example, we're about 85 people now, including a handful of contractors. The hard part, when it comes to the developer side, obviously we all know the languages were different, right? So obviously training from someone to go from one technology to another, if they have a CS degree and they're familiar with some of the baseline C or Java, it hasn't been an issue. For others, it has been an issue. So we obviously have had to hire for that skill set. It really comes down to our UI, UX, IA people and the true designers, getting them to think mobile first now, which is really important. They're going to think about, you know, responsive web design, responsive layout. It's something that is taking time. But the beauty of it, honestly, is that there are a lot of people that have been designing for mobile and for alternative screens for a long time. So they're out there. So for us, we've actually been hiring some awesome people that are just doing a great job. And the people who really want to engage in it are making that transition. And we do workshops, we do trainings in-house. And, you know, people talk about a lot. It's been really collaborative in this transition. And we've been making the transition for about 6 years now. So right. It's, but the iPad was, I will say, when the iPad came out, people were more excited on our team than the iPhone. Because then all of a sudden, these web designers are like, okay, more screen real estate. Cool, I can do a lot more with this. So
Calvin, you used to own an interactive agency back in the heyday, I think. And now you're focused on apps. What do you see the difference in kind of skills or methodologies or whatever?
So I think I'd like to use an example to kind of explain our opinion on web design versus app design. When the original iPad came out, we had several apps available the day it came out, and one of them was NPR for iPad. So it's a native app designed for iPad, very, very interesting, physical, gesture-based experience for NPR. The same day that that came out, NPR was one of the launch partners for Apple for the iPad-compatible website campaign they did, basically taking all the flash off and kind of relooking at your site, and them and CNN and New York Times and a bunch of other ones had these very usable, very optimized full websites for iPad as well. So every iPad, as you know, ships with Safari, and everyone, I think, understands how to go to the web and type in an address, and everyone knows that NPR.org is there and that they could use it on their iPad. So I'm going to argue that there is a very low barrier for a user to use NPR.org on their iPad. And I'm going to argue that there's a much higher barrier, although not very high because of the magic of the App Store, is a much higher barrier for them to even know that NPR had an app out in the first, you know, day or in the weeks and the months after the iPad. And, you know, the time it takes to get it and download it and all that other fun stuff. There was and still is a 5 times different in user engagement and use of the NPR for iPad app versus the site. So the app is used 5 times as much as the site. That is shocking. That doesn't make any sense.
Wait, the app is used 5 times longer, or there's 5 times more users of the app than the web version?
5 times more engagement.
Right.
So basically, there is 5 times as much traffic, 5 times as much use, 5 times as much users. I'm serious. This is a big deal. So we believe it's a survey of one, but frankly, the numbers are so important. I think it would be silly to not stop for a second and think about that. That means, when given an opportunity, when given a choice, users with their free will want a mobile designed experience. They are no longer interested in a web design experience when given the opportunity to choose. And that is, in my opinions, across every industry. There's a really interesting book out called Mobile First. I forget the talented author's name right now. But I completely agree with Brian that if you're in the business of web design and you have no interest in even moving to mobile, steal from mobile. You will build the most beautiful and most usable and most compelling future-focused websites if you steal directly what mobile is doing.
Okay. So we'll move on a little bit. I'm sort of curious. I mean, we obviously had this kind of discussion yesterday about the app market and how well it works and concerns. And so, Randy, why don't you tell me a little bit, like, what's your basic feeling about the app market now and how it works well for you and where there sort of needs to be some improvement?
Well, I think it works well for us because, like I said, it gives us a lot of opportunities to create products that we just, frankly, can't do in the bookstore right now. You know, what we find challenging is that there's just so much activity there. There's so many apps being produced. There are so many app developers. There's so many publishers. In book publishing, you know, there's the big six. There's six. There's small publishers, but we know who our competition is, and the industry has been chugging along for many, many years, and it's the known playing field. And the app market's kind of the Wild West, right? You have a lot of, you know, 2-3-person shops, as Brian said, who can go out there and create this killer product, and all of a sudden, you know, they're ruling the marketplace. So, you know, we're going at it from a different angle. It's like a new way to create products. And we've had great success launching our products. We've, you know, gotten a lot of promotions. The key is after that first couple weeks, how do you keep it going?
Right. Okay.
How does somebody know your app is there? Where's the discoverability is a challenge because there's just so much product.
Right. And, you know, we've had discussions about, you know, sort of a few people controlling sort of the app market. So obviously you want to produce an app, you know, you have to put it, if it's an Apple app, it only goes to one place, Apple has to approve it. And in some ways, what I do think is interesting is like when I said in the beginning, when you look back at when the web came out, there was a lot of principles of the web about openness and, you know, there wasn't a single gatekeeper and this neutrality. And I do think it's a whole really interesting thing sort of as we look in the future, is that sort of a model that will continue? It broke once, you know, sort of will it break again?
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, it's a loaded question too because it's like listen, like once again, Apple's given us the opportunity, and last night's conversation was really fun. We're not going to repeat it here, you know.
Sure.
But I will say that they've given us the opportunity And when I say they and us, means everyone. We can be an established company, big publisher, small developer, and it gives us the opportunity to have presence in a market to get our work out there. And I will say the app market...
With a gate.
With a gate. There is a gate. But I'll say I used to get so frustrated. I mean, if you were in mobile, it was... Raise your hands if you were in mobile 5, 6, 8 years ago, dealing with AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, you know, and it was like...
He's giving
yeah,
me
exactly.
Down.
I mean, nice people, but, you know, a few people on the other side...
Well, let's do this. Who's in mobile now?
Who's in mobile
in
now?
Any way
yeah, how about that?
I mean, look at the
yeah.
unlocking. That is like
yeah, that
a 4,000%
right
increase.
Because
just right there.
The gate was huge back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
It was like, if you were not one of the top five publishers, much like book publishing, getting into a bookstore, right, you could not get on deck on a carrier deck.
Oh, yeah.
And they owned you, man. I mean, it was like, you were like, their life was like, oh, if they love us, we're going to make money. And if they don't love us, God, we're dead. That's it. And they tried off-deck models. We tried off-deck models for a long time. We were lucky. We were on Verizon exclusives for over a year, and we made money. But if we had not gone on there, we wouldn't have had a mobile business.
It was and the reality so, is, yeah. is that 95% or more of apps are approved by Apple literally within a matter of days.
Yep.
That's the reality.
Yep.
That's the facts. There are very few, literally a handful of apps that never get approved. And there are good reasons why most of, if not all, because I don't know every single story, those don't get approved. There is, Apple has laid out an unbelievably generous ecosystem. It's not called an app store. It's an entire ecosystem. It has enabled a complete transformation and revolution in humans and their connections with content. And the very important thing to understand is that no one is holding a gun to a single user's head and being told to buy an iPhone, to being told to buy an iPad. It is from a position of free will to spend all that money to buy a beautiful device and get all this great content. No one is holding a gun to my head or Randy's head or Steve's head or Brian's head to build solutions for these things.
Okay.
Users vote with their dollars, they vote with their feet, and they vote with their hearts. So this is actually a wonderful thing, and it's much better than the old days when you didn't know whether or not you're going to get a deal with Nokia or not.
Yeah.
You didn't know whether or not you're going to meet the guy and go to dinner and be able to cut some deal. The rule sets are very very generous, and they're very well laid out. And I think it's time that we stop like complaining about it and take all that energy that we're using to complain about it and put it into building wonderful things for our users.
It is a bit disruptive, isn't it?
Yeah, can I just say one quick thing from a publisher perspective? What I find intriguing about the App Store is that for the first time, publishers have access to the consumer, which we never did before. We consider our customer to be the booksellers. And now we started thinking about what our users really want and really catering to them more in some ways. For instance, like we published a zombie product and, you know, big shock, a lot of people who are zombie fans are on Android. Like we never, you know, we threw something into the App Store and then, you know, it's doing really well, don't get me wrong, but we suddenly had access to our consumers and we found out maybe we should do some studies and we realized Android fans are zombie fans, right? And it made us really change the way we think about what markets we publish into and what products we develop for which platforms.
Right. Critical research there.
Yep. Yeah, it's
okay,
good.
I have a couple more questions, but if people could line up maybe in front of the mic, give me a sense of how many people want to ask some questions, then I'll ask less myself. So, okay.
All right.
Maybe I'll just go to questions. I will just say, because I like to keep on digging back with Calvin, that, you know, Microsoft said all those same things, too, about no one's holding a gun to them, and look what happened to their monopolistic things. But questions.
Users don't want what Microsoft has.
So I know that none of us here want this to happen, but the CD-ROM kind of died off. Do you all see that happening with the iPad? These apps, these new interactive experiences that y'all are making right now, they do have a lot of investment. You aren't always seeing ROI that is positive.
The answer I have to that is I don't really care if it does or doesn't. I only care about producing wonderful things for users.
Yeah.
And I ship products today. I'm not shipping products 5 years from now today. I'll do that 5 years from now. And so I use the technology that is best today to serve users today. The reasons that Bottle Rocket doesn't produce HTML underpinned apps, meaning the underpinning the technology of the apps being HTML5, is because it is extremely poor technology for the underpinnings of an app. It's a wonderful technology. It's a media type. And we involve it as a media type But because we ship today, we're not building apps with crappy tools. We're building with the best tools possible for the best devices possible for the most demanding users. And 5 years from now, I hope something changes. I hope it gets better. But today, this is absolutely the place to be.
Okay. Next question.
Yeah, my name's Christopher Allen. I have a new iPad app called Infinite Canvas. Back when, in the CD-ROM days, a lot of the apps were written on top of HyperCard. I don't remember, you know, if you look at Cosmic Osmo, Myst, you know, that whole realm of things, which had its roots in the ability for allow anybody to be able to create. Do you find for, you know, your production teams, for your things, the lack of something that is just a little bit lower barrier of entry to authors to try things to be a big factor in your costs, your distribution, your ability to try experiments?
Do you mean the coding technologies and things like that, or just far as...
So you're looking for some lower entry ways.
Well, it's hard because it was, you know, ultimately, you know, we, so for our company, we've created over 500 games. We've created hundreds of websites. We were like the top Flash studio, and that used to matter, you know? And so we found with Flash that we had a lot of guys that were just hobbyists, people that were hobbyists and never actually had a CS degree or whatever. The actual, it's interesting now, the type of developers that we're bringing on are pretty hardcore. I mean, these guys are really deep coders, and they know a lot of different languages. So, yeah, there is now a barrier to entry, but it all depends upon how you define that, right? So I still believe, I mean, I remember we had one coder who was 19 years old, graduated from high school, never got a CS degree, one of our best developers ever, and he was actually a Flash developer that taught himself Objective-C and kicked butt. So, yeah.
There's a kind of a dearth of what I'll call prosumer tools. We used to build CD-ROM stuff back when Macromine Director and Apple Media Tool. And I loved Apple Media Tool. It was object-oriented. You could get into the code if you wanted to, but it was also a very simple kind of GUI interface in the spirit of HyperCard that you know, kind of mortals could get in there and build really cool things. There are some IDEs, if you're going to be into games, I would do your games in Unity 3D, which is still pretty hardcore, but at least in its abstraction layer, and it gives you a lot of free stuff. At Bottle Rocket, we don't produce with the following tools I'm going to tell you, because we're producing these like super high performance applications. But you should look at like Titanium from Accelerator. It makes it a little bit more accessible, but frankly, it starts to get a little bit crazy too because of the extreme variant of Java that they're using. There is this kind of dearth, but I think that's also something that's also a business opportunity where people can build tools for a certain level of apps, just like history repeats itself, and there were so many kind of web in a box type tools, make a website type tools. Those are coming out for apps as well.
Okay, next question.
Hi, my name is Jeremy Olson, and first of all, really great conversation. I'm really been good. I own an app design company, small app design company called Tapity, and we're beginning some actual content producers, authors coming directly to us that want to make some kind of app or something. And actually, one thing that I was surprised y'all didn't talk about too much was iBooks and iBook Author, because that's one thing that we've been considering for them, because they don't have a whole lot of money. They're the content producers. So is that, to you guys, does that seem kind of gimmicky, you know, using iBook Author? I mean, as designers, we also do development, but we think it's a pretty cool opportunity, because we can design some really cool user experiences, but without so much of the cost of the production of the development. So
yeah, we are going to be rolling out some things on iBooks Author. It is one of the tools in our toolkit. Random House actually has the biggest complex ebook team in the industry, and we produce files for various different retailers. The challenge that we find is we like to distribute our content everywhere.
Right.
And iBook Author is great for iBooks, but you can't reuse the files, which we find somewhat challenging. But it is definitely interesting, and we're going to see how our content looks on it. I think that you'll see a lot of evolution over the next year in what it can do. I'm excited to see it grow.
If you have content that would work within the iBooks construct, do it today. The bookstore needs content, and that's a massive business opportunity for early adopters. There's a reason why The first 1,000 or so apps on the App Store made an enormous amount of money relative to the quality of the product. If you have that opportunity, you should be home right now cranking out iBooks using iBooks Author, getting it up there. Great content means, and a great user experience is a guaranteed success. And frankly, you can go over the top and get in front of some categories that publishers, maybe traditional publishers, are taking too long to bring to market. That's a great thing about new transformations of technology. It lets guys like you and me get on top.
Awesome. Thank you.
Okay. Unfortunately, I believe we're out of time, but I think the panel's...
Can it be quick? I'm sorry. It's one, I think, a really important question that I didn't think it covered. And when we were talking about gatekeepers and environments, which is related to a biology terminology, which I completely agree with, being that I was a biology undergrad. But here's my question is, I don't think any... This was addressed in the fact of... Now, user recommendations and reviews. If we're talking about an environment and ecosystem, the environmental pressure that's causing evolution of games and things that are being very successful is the fact that that users is a very democratic way for people to evaluate products. And as me, it has stopped me from spending anywhere from $20 to $5 when I saw, don't get this buggy, or hey, it looks great, but it's not great, or hey, get this app, it's amazing, this will change your life. Yeah. How do you guys feel? Is this going to be something where it actually opens up into a business where people get good at rating these apps and games, or is it going to be something that we better develop?
I'm getting the cut sign. Come up and ask these people directly, and they'll be able to answer.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you very much.